Chapter 12. Fanchula, the Downs, the 20th of September, 04. My dear sir, by desire of your son William, my brave and respectable midshipman, I write a hasty line to inform you of our brush with the French last week. The claim of distinction which has been bestowed on the ship I commanded, I must entirely, after God, attribute to the zeal and fidelity of my officers, amongst whom your son stands conspicuous. He is very well, and I hope will continue so. He had the misfortune of being wounded a few minutes after boarding the Fanchula, and his arm is so badly broken that I fear it must suffer amputation. But as it is his left arm, and likely to do well under the great skill of Dr. Maturin, I hope you will think it an honourable mark instead of a misfortune. We ran into Chaulieu Road on the 14th instant, and had the annoyance of grounding in a fog under the crossfire of their batteries, when it became necessary to cut out a vessel to heave us off. We chose a ship moored under one of the batteries, and proceeded with all dispatch in the boats. It was in taking her that your son received his wound. And she proved to be the Ligurian corvetto Fanchula of 20 guns with some French officers. We then proceeded to attack the transports, your son exerting himself all this time with the utmost gallantry, of which we took one, sank one, and drove five ashore. At this point the Polycrest unfortunately sank, having been hulled by upwards of 200 shot, and having beaten 5 hours on the bank. We therefore proceeded in the prizes to the Downs, where the court-martial, sitting yesterday afternoon in the Monarch, most honourably acquitted the Polycrest's officers for the loss of their ship, not without some very obliging remarks. You will find a fuller account of this little action in my Gazette letter, which appears in tomorrow's newspaper, and in which I have the pleasure of naming your son. And since I am this moment bound for the Admiralty, I shall have the pleasure of mentioning him to the First Lord. My best compliments wait on Mrs. Babington, and I am, my dear sir, with great truth, sincerely yours, John Aubrey. Postscript. Dr. Maturin desires his compliments, and wishes me to say that the arm may very well be saved. But, I may add, he is the best hand in the fleet, with a saw, if it comes to that, which I'm sure will be a comfort to you and Mrs. Babington. "Killick," he cried, folding and sealing it. "That's for the post. Is the doctor ready?"
"Ready and waiting these 14 minutes," said Stephen in a loud, sour voice. "What a wretched, tedious, slow hand you are with a pen upon my soul. Scratch, scratch, gasp, gasp. You might have written the Iliad in half the time, and a commentary upon it, too."
"I'm truly sorry, my dear fellow. I hate writing letters. It don't seem to come natural, somehow."
"Non omnia possumus omnes," said Stephen. "But at least we can step into a boat at a stated time, can we not? Now here is your physic, and here is your bolus. And remember, a quart of porter with your breakfast, a quart at midday..."
They reached the deck. A scene of very great activity. Swabs, squeegees, holy stones, prayer books, bears grinding in all directions. Her 20 brass guns hot with polishing. The smell of paint. For the Fanchulas, late Polycrests, had heard that their prize was to be bought into the service, and they felt that a pretty ship would fetch a higher price than a slattern. A price that concerned them intimately, since 3/8 of it would be theirs. "You will bear my recommendations in mind, Mr. Parker," said Jack, preparing to go down the side. "Oh, yes, sir," cried Parker. "All this is voluntary." He looked at Jack with great earnestness. Apart from any other reason, the lieutenant's entire future hung on what his captain would say of him at the Admiralty that evening. Jack nodded, took the side ropes with a careful grasp, and lowered himself slowly into the boat. A ragged, good-natured, but very brief cheer as it pushed off, and the Fanchulas hurried back to their scouring, currying, and polishing.
The surveyor was due at 9 o'clock. A little to the left, to the larboard, said Stephen. Where was I? A quart of porter with your dinner. No wine, though you may take a glass or two of cold negus before retiring. No beef or mutton. Fish, I say. Chicken. A pair of rabbits. And, of course, venerem omite. Eh? Oh, her, yes, certainly. Quite so. Very proper. Rowed off all. Run her up. The boat ground through the shingle. They ploughed across the beach, crossed the road into the dunes. Here? Asked Jack. Just past the gibbet. A little dell, a place I know convenient in every way. Here we are. They turned a dune, and there was a dark green postchaise and its postillion eating his breakfast out of a cloth bag. I wish we could have worked the hearse, muttered Jack. Stuff! Your own father wouldn't recognise you in that bandage and this dirty yellow come-kiss-me-death ex-sanguine state. Though indeed you look fitter for a hearse than many a subject I've cut up. Come, come, there's not a moment to lose. Get in, mind the step. Preserved Killick, take good care of the captain. His physic well shaken twice a day, the bolus thrice. He may offer to forget his bolus, Killick. He'll take his nice bolus, sir, or my name's not preserved. Clap to the door. Give way now. Give way altogether. Step out. Lay aloft. Tally. And belay. They stood watching the dust of the postchaise. And Bondon said, Oh, I do wish as we'd worked the hearse and coffin, Larkser. If they was to nab him now, it'd break my heart.
How can you be so simple, Bondon? Do but think of a hearse and four cracking on regardless all the way up the Dover Road. It would be bound to excite comment. And you are to consider that a recumbent posture is bad for the captain at present.
Well, sir, but a hearse is sure. No bum ever arrested a corpse as I know of. Howsoever, it's too late now.
Shall you pull back along of us, sir, or shall we come for you again?
I'm obliged to you, Bondon, but I believe I shall walk into Dover and take a boat back from there. The postchaise whirled through Kent, saying little. Ever since Chaulieu, Jack had been haunted by the dread of tipstaffs. His return to the Downs, with no ship and a couple of prizes, had made a good deal of noise. Very favourable noise, but still noise. And he hadn't set foot on shore until this morning, refusing invitations even from the Lord Warden himself. He was moderately well-to-do. The Fanchula might bring him close on £1,000, and the transport £100 or £200. But would the Admiralty pay head money according to the Fanchula's muster roll, when so many of her people had escaped on shore? And would his claim for gun money for the destroyed transports be allowed? His new prize agent had shaken his head, saying he could promise nothing but delay. He had advanced a fair sum, however, and Jack's bosom had the pleasant crinkle of Bank of England notes. Yet he was nowhere near being solvent. And passing through Canterbury, Rochester and Dartford, he cowered deep in his corner. Stephen's assurances had little force with him. He knew he was Jack Aubrey, and it seemed inevitable that others too should see him as Jack Aubrey. Debtor to Grobian, Slendrian and Company for £11,012 6s 8d. With better reason, it seemed to him inevitable that those interested should know that he must necessarily be summoned to the Admiralty and take their steps accordingly. He didn't get out when they changed horses. He passed most of the journey keeping out of sight and dozing. He was perpetually tired these days. And he was asleep when Killick roused him with a respectful but firm time for your bolus, sir. Jack eyed it. This was, perhaps, the most nauseating dose that Stephen had ever yet compounded, so vile that health itself was scarcely worth the price of swallowing it. "I can't get it down without a drink," he said. "Hold hard," cried Killick, putting his head and shoulders out of the window. Postboy ahoy! Pull in at the next public, do you hear me, dear? Now, sir, as the carriage came to a stop, I'll just step in and see if the coast is clear. Killick had spent little of his life ashore, and most of that little in an amphibious village in the Essex mud. But he was fly. He knew a great deal about landsmen, most of whom were crimps, pickpockets, whores, all officials of the Sick and Hurt Office, and he could tell a gum a mile off. He saw them everywhere. He was the worst possible companion for a weak, reduced, anxious debtor that could well be found, the more so in that his absolute copper-bottom certainty of being a right deep file, no sort or kind of a flat, carried a certain conviction. By way of a ruse de guerre, he had somehow acquired a clergyman's hat. And this, combined with his earrings, his yard of pigtail, his watchet blue jacket with brass buttons, his white trousers and low silver-buckled shoes, succeeded so well that several customers followed him from the tap-room to gaze while he leant in and said to Jack, "It's no go, sir. I've seen some slang coves in the tap. You'll have to drink it in the shay." "Well, let me, sir. Dog's nose. Flip. Come, sir," he said with the authority of the well over the sick in their care, or even out of it. "What'll it be? For down it must go, or it'll miss the tide." Jack thought he would like a little sherry. "Oh, no, sir, no wine," the doctor said. "No wine. Porter's more the mark." He brought back sherry. Had been obliged to call for wine, it being a sherry, and a mug of porter. Drank the sherry, gave back such change as he saw fit, and watched the bowlers go gasping, retching down, helped by the porter. "That's thundering good physic," he said. "Drive on, mate." The next time he woke Jack, it was from a deeper sleep. "Hey, what's amiss?" cried Jack.
"We're alongside, sir. We're there."
"Aye, aye, so we are," said Jack, gazing at the familiar doorway, the familiar courtyard, and suddenly coming to life. "Very well. Killick, stand off and on, and when you see my signal, drive smartly in and pick me up again." He was sure of a fairly kind reception at the Admiralty. The cutting out of the Fanchula had been well spoken of in the service and very well spoken of in the press. It had come at a time when there was little to fill the papers, and when people were feeling nervous and low in their spirits about the invasion. The Polycrest couldn't have chosen a better moment for sinking. Nothing could have earned her more praise. The journalists were delighted with the fact that both ships were nominally sloops and that the Fanchula carried almost twice as many men. They didn't point out that 80 of the Fanchulas were peaceable Italian conscripts, and they were good enough to number the little guns borne by the transports in the general argument. One gentleman in the post, particularly dear to Jack's heart, had spoken of this gallant, nay, amazing feat, carried out by a raw crew far below its complement and consisting largely of landsmen and boys. It must show the French Emperor the fate that necessarily awaits his invasion flotilla, for if our lion-hearted tars handle it so roughly when it is skulking behind impenetrable sandbanks under the crossfire of imposing batteries, what may they not do should it ever put to sea? There was a good deal more about hearts of oak and honest tars, which had pleased the Fanchulas. The more literate hearts perpetually read it to the rest from the thumbed copies that circulated through the ship, and Jack knew that it would please the Admiralty too. In spite of their lordly station, they were as sensitive to loud public praise as common mortals. He knew that this approval would grow after the publication of his official letter, with its grim list of casualties, 17 dead and 23 wounded, for civilians liked to have sailors' blood to deplore, and the more a victory cost, the more it was esteemed. If only little Parslow could have contrived to get himself knocked on the head, it would have been perfect. He also knew something that the papers did not know, but that the Admiralty did. The Fanchula's captain hadn't had the time or the wit to destroy his secret papers. And for the moment the French private signals were private no longer. Their codes were broken.
But as he sat there in the waiting room, thoughts of past misdeeds filled his uneasy mind. Anything that Admiral Hart's malignance could do would have been done. And, in fact, he had not behaved irreproachably in the Downs. Stephen's warning had fallen on a raw conscience, and it could only have come through Dundas. Dundas, who was so well placed to know what they thought of his conduct here. If his logs and order books were sent for, there would be some things he would find hard to explain away. Those strokes of profound cunning, those little stratagems that had seemed individually so impenetrable, now in the mass took on a sadly imbecile appearance. And how did the Polycrest come to be on the sandbank in the first place? Explain that, you infernal lubber. So he was more than usually pleased when Lord Melville rose from behind his desk, shook him warmly by the hand, and cried, "Captain Aubrey, I'm delighted to see you. I said you would be very sure to distinguish yourself. Do you recall? I said so in this very room, and now you have done so, sir. The Bard is content, pleased, eminently satisfied with its choice of you as commander of the Polycrest, and with your conduct at Chaulieu. I wish you could have done so with less cost. I'm afraid you suffered terribly, both in your ship's company and in your person. Tell me," he said, looking at Jack's head, "what is the nature of your wounds? Do they hurt?"
"Why, no, my lord, I cannot say they do."
"How were they inflicted?"
"Well, my lord, the one was something that dropped on my head, a piece of mortar shell, I imagine, but luckily I was in the water at the time, so it did little damage, only tearing off a hand's breadth of scalp. The other was a sword thrust I didn't notice at the moment, but it seems it nicked some vessel and most of my blood ran out before I was aware. Dr. Matchin said he didn't suppose there was more than 3 ounces left, and that mostly in my toes."
"You are in good hands, I find."
"Oh, yes, my lord. He clapped a red-hot iron to the place, brought up the bleeding with a round turn, and set me up directly."
"Pray, what did he prescribe?"
asked Lord Melville, who was intensely interested in his own body, and so in bodies in general.
"Soup, my lord. Enormous quantities of soup. And barley water and fish. Physic, of course. A green physic. And porter."
"Porter? Is porter good for the blood? I shall try some today. Dr. Merchant is a remarkable man."
"He is indeed, my lord.
Our butcher's bill would have been far, far longer but for his devotion. The men think the world of him. They subscribe to present him with a gold-headed cane."
"Good. Good, very good.
Now, I have your official letter here, and I see that you mention all your officers with great approval, particularly Pullings, Babington, and Goodridge the master. By the by, I hope young Babington's wound is not too grave. His father voted with us in the last 2 divisions out of compliments to the service.
His arm was broken by a musket shot as we boarded, my lord, but he tucked it into his jacket and fought on in a most desperate fashion. And afterwards, as soon as it was dressed, he came on deck again and behaved extremely well.
So you're truly satisfied with all your officers? With Mr. Parker?"
"More than satisfied with them all, my lord."
Lord Melville felt the hint of evasion and said, "Is he fit to command?" looking straight into Jack's eye.
"Yes, my lord."
Turmoil of conscience. Immediate loyalty and fellow feeling overcoming good sense, responsibility, love of truth, love of the service, all other considerations.
"I'm glad to hear it. Prince William has been pressing us for some time on the subject of his old shipmate."
He touched his bell, and a clerk came in with an envelope. At the sight of it, Jack's heart began to beat wildly.
his thin, sparse blood to race about his body. Yet his face turned extremely pale.
"This is an interesting occasion, Captain Aubra. You must allow me the pleasure of being the first to congratulate you on your promotion. I've stretched a point, and you are made post with seniority from May the 23rd.
"Thank you, my lord. Thank you very much indeed," cried Jack, flushing scarlet now. It gives me very great pleasure to receive it from your hands. Even greater pleasure from the handsome way in which it is given. I am very deeply obliged to you, my lord."
"Well, well, there we are," said Lord Melville, quite touched. Sit down, Captain Aubrey. You're looking far from well. What are your plans? I dare say your health requires you to take some months of sick leave."
"Oh, no, my lord. Oh, very far from it. It was only a passing weakness, quite gone now. And Dr. Maturin assures me that my particular constitution calls for sea air, nothing but sea air, as far from land as possible."
"Well, you cannot have the Fanchula, of course, since she'll not be rated a post-ship. What the gods give with one hand, they take away with the other. And seeing that you cannot have her, then, in compliment to you, it seems but just that she should be given to your first lieutenant."
"Thank you, my lord," said Jack, with a face so dashed and glum that the other looked at him with surprise.
"However," he said, "I think we may hold out some hope of a frigate. The Blackwater, she's on the stocks, and all being well, she may be launched in 6 months. That'll give you time to recover your strength, to see your friends, and to watch over her fitting out from the very beginning."
"My lord," cried Jack, "I do not know how to thank you for your goodness to me, and indeed I'm ashamed to ask for more, having had so much. But, to be quite frank with you, my affairs were thrown into such a state of confusion by the breaking of my prize agent that something is quite necessary to me. A temporary command or anything."
"You were with that villain Jackson?" asked Lord Melville, looking at him from under his bushy eyebrows. "So was poor Robert. He lost better than £2,000, a cahoopit sum. Well, well. So you would accept an acting command, however short?"
"Most willingly, my lord. However short or however inconvenient, with both hands."
"There may be some slight fleeting remote possibility. I don't commit myself, mind. The Athalian's commander is sick. There is Captain Hammond's lively, and Lord Carlo's immortality. They both wish to attend Parliament, I know. There are other service members too, but I have not the details in my head. I'll desire Mr. Bainton to look into it when he has a moment. There's no certainty in these matters, you understand. Where are you staying, since you will not be rejoining the Fanciulla?"
"At the Grapes in the Savoy, my lord."
"In the Savoy?" said Lord Melville, writing it down. "Oh, aye, just so. Now, have we any more official business?"
"If I might be permitted an observation, my lord. The Polycrest's people behaved exceedingly well. They couldn't have done better. But if they were left together in a body, there might be unpleasant consequences. It seems to me they would be far better drafted in small parties to ships of the line."
"Is this a general impression, Captain Aubrey, or can you bring forward any names, however tentatively?"
"A general impression, my lord."
"It shall be attended to. So much for business. If you are not bespoke, it would give Lady Melville and me great pleasure if you would dine with us on Sunday. Robert will be there, and Heneage." "Thank you, my lord. I shall be very happy indeed to wait upon Lady Melville.
Then let me wish you joy once more, and bid you a very good day.
Joy. As he walked heavily, solemnly down the stairs, it mounted in him. A great, calm flood tide of joy. His momentary disappointment about the Fanciulla, he'd counted on her. Such a quick, stiff, sweet-handling Weatherly pet, entirely vanished by the third step, forgotten, overwhelmed. And by the landing he had realised his happiness almost to the full. He had been made post. He was a post-captain, and he would die an admiral at last. He gazed with quiet benevolence at the hall-porter in his red waistcoat, smiling and bobbing at the foot of the stairs.
"Give you joy, sir," said Tom. "But, oh, dear me, sir, you're improperly dressed."
"Thank you, Tom," said Jack, rising a little way out of his beatitude. "Eh?" He cast a quick glance down his front.
"No, no, sir," said Tom, guiding him into the shelter of the hooded leather porter's chair and unfastening the epaulette on his left shoulder to transfer it to his right. "There. You had your swab shipped like a mere commander. There. That's better. Why, bless you, I did that for Lord Viscount Nelson when he come down those stairs made post."
"Did you indeed, Tom?" said Jack, intensely pleased. The thing was materially impossible, but it delighted him, and he emitted a stream of gold. A moderate stream, but enough to make Tom very affable, affectionate, and brisk in hailing the chaise and bringing it into the court. He woke slowly, in a state of wholly relaxed comfort, blinking with ease. He had gone to bed at 9, as soon as he had swallowed his bolus and his tankard of porter, and he had slept the clock round, a sleep full of diffused happiness and a longing to impart it, a longing too oppressed by languor to have any effect. Some exquisite dreams. The Magdalen in Queenie's picture saying, "Why do not you tune your fiddle to orange tawny, yellow, green, and this blue, instead of those old common notes?" It was so obvious. He and Stephen set to their tuning, the cello brown and full crimson, and they dashed away in colour alone. Such colour! But he couldn't seize it again. It was fading into no more than words. It no longer made evident luminous good sense. His bandaged head, mulling about dreams, how they sometimes made sense and how sometimes they did not, suddenly shot from the pillow, all the pink happiness wiped off it. His coat, which had slipped from the back of the chair, looked exactly like the coat of yesterday, but there, exactly squared and trimmed on the chimney-piece, stood that material sailcloth envelope, that valuable envelope or wrapper. He sprang out of bed, fetched it, returned, poised it on his chest above the sheets, and went to sleep again. Killick was moving about the room, making an unnecessary noise, kicking things, not altogether by accident, cursing steadily. He was in a vile temper. He could be smelt from the pillow. Jack had given him a guinea to drink to his swab, and he'd done so conscientiously down to the last penny, being brought home on a shutter. "Now, sir," he said, coughing artificially, "time for this here bolus." Jack slept on. "It's no good coming at the Abram, sir. I seen you twitch. Down it must go. Post-captain or no post-captain," he added, possibly to himself. "You'll post it down, my lord, or I'll know the reason why. And your nice porter, too." About 12, Jack got up.
stared at the back of his head with his shaving mirror and the looking-glass. It seemed to be healing well, but as Stephen had shaved the whole crown, leaving the long hair at the back, he had an oddly criminal look of alopecia or the common mange. Dressed in civilian clothes and walked out to see the light of day, for none ever reached the grapes at any time of the year. Before leaving, he asked at the bar for an exact description of the Savoy, the boundaries of the sanctuary. He was particularly interested in these old survivals, he said.
You may go as far as Falconer's Rents, and then cut through to Essex Street and go along as far as the fourth house from the corner, then right back to the city side of Cecil Street. But don't ever you cross it, nor don't ever you pass the posts in Sweating House Lane, Your Honour, or all's up. U.P. up, said the grapes, who heard this piece about interesting old survivals 100 times a year.
He walked up and down the streets of the duchy, stepped into a coffee house, and idly picked up the paper. His own Gazette letter leapt straight out of the open page at him, with its absurdly familiar phrasing and his signature quite transmogrified by print. On the same page there was a piece about the action. It said that our gallant tars were never happier than when they were fighting against odds of 12 1/8 to 1, which was news to Jack. How had the man arrived at that figure? Presumably by adding up all the guns and mortars in the batteries, and all the vessels afloat in the bay, and dividing by the Polycrest. But apart from this odd notion of happiness, the man obviously had sense, and he obviously knew something about the Navy. Captain Aubrey, said he, was known as an officer who was very careful of his men's lives. That's right, said Jack. And he asked how it came about that the Polycrest, with all her notorious defects, was sent on a mission for which she was so entirely unsuited when there were other vessels, naming them, lying idle in the Downs. A casualty list of a third of the ship's company called for explanation. The Sophie, under the same commander, had taken the Cacafuego with a loss of no more than 3 men killed. Pass that, you old cunt, said Jack inwardly to Admiral Hart. Wandering out, he came to the back of the chapel. An organ was playing inside. A sweet, light-footed organ, hunting a fugue through its charming complexities. He circled the railings to come to the door, but he had scarcely found it, opened it, and settled himself in a pew before the whole elaborate structure collapsed in a dying wheeze, and a thick boy crept from a hole under the loft and clashed down the aisle, whistling. It was a strong disappointment, the sudden breaking of a delightful tension, like being dismasted under full sail. "What a disappointment, sir," he said to the organist who had emerged into the dim light. "I had so hoped you'd bring it to a close." "Alas, I have no wind," said the organist, an elderly parson. "That chuff lad has blown his hour, and no power on earth will keep him in. But I'm glad you liked the organ. It's a Father Smith." "A musician, sir?" "Oh, the merest dilettante, sir, but I should be happy to blow for you if you choose to go on. It would be a sad shame to leave Handel up in the air for want of wind." "Should you indeed? You're very good, sir. Let me show you the handle. You understand these things, I'm sure. I must hurry to the loft, or these young people will be here. I have a marriage very soon." So Jack pumped, and the music wound away and away, the separate strands following one another in baroque flights and twirls, until at last they came together and ran to the final magnificence, astonishing the young couple who had come silently in and who were sitting furtive, embarrassed, nervous, and intensely clean in the shadows, with their landlady and a midwife. For they had not paid for music, only the simplest ceremony. They were absurdly young, pretty creatures, with little more than a gasp between them. And they had anticipated the rites by a hair's breadth under full term. But the parson joined them very gravely, telling them that the purpose of their union was the getting of children, and that it was better to marry than to burn. When it was over, they came to life again, regained their colour, smiled, seemed very pleased with being married, amazed at themselves. Jack kissed the pink bride, shook the other child by the hand, wishing him all possible good fortune, and walked out into the air smiling with pleasure. How happy they'll be, poor young things. Mutual support, no loneliness, no goddamn solitude. Tell happiness and sorrows quite openly. Sweet child. Not the least trace of the shrew. Trusting, confident. Marriage a very capital thing, quite different from... By God, I'm on the wrong side of Cecil Street. He turned to cross back, and as he turned, he collided with a sharp youth who had darted after him through the traffic with a paper in his hand. "Captain Aubrey, sir?" asked the youth. Escape to the other side was impossible. He shot a glance behind him. Surely they couldn't hope to make the arrest with just this younker. "They told me at the Grapes I should find you walking about the Duchy, Your Honour." There was no menace in his voice, only a modest satisfaction. "I should have hollered out but for manners." "Who are you?" asked Jack, still poised to deal with him. "Tom's Nevy, Your Honour, if you please, the duty porter. Which I was to give you this." Handing the letter. "Thank you, boy," said Jack, unpoising himself. "You're a sharp lad. Tell your uncle I'm obliged to him, and this is for your errand." A gap appeared in the traffic, and he darted back into Lancaster, back to the Grapes, called for a glass of brandy, and sat down in greater flutter of spirits than he had ever known. "No brandy, sir," said Killick, cutting the potboy off at the head of the stairs and confiscating the little glass. "No spirits of wine," the doctor said. "Swab face, you jump to the bar and draw the captain a quart of porter, and none of your gardo moves with the froth." "Killick," said Jack, "God damn your eyes. Cut along to the kitchen and desire Mrs. Broad to step up." "Mrs. Broad, what have you for dinner? I'm amazing sharp set." "No beef or mutton, Mr. Killick says," said Mrs. Broad, "but I've a nice loin of wheel and a nice piece of wenison, as plump as you could wish a tender young doe, sir." "The wenison, if you please, Mrs. Broad, and perhaps you would send me up some pens and a pot of ink." "Ah, dear God," he said to the empty room, "a tender young doe." The Grapes, Saturday. "My dear Stephen," he wrote, "oh, wish me joy, I made post. I never thought it would be, though he received me in the kindest way, but then suddenly he popped it out, signed, sealed and delivered with seniority from May the 23rd. It was like a prodigious, unexpected, vast, great broadside from a three-decker, but of happiness. I couldn't get it all aboard directly, I was so taken aback, but by the time I'd smuggled myself back to the Grapes, I was swelling like a rose, so happy. How I wish you'd been there. I celebrated with a quart of your vile porter and a bolus, and turned in at once quite fagged out. This morning I was very much better, however, and in the Savoy Chapel I said the finest thing in my life. The parson was playing a Handel fugue. The organ boy deserted his post, and I said, 'It would be a pity to leave Handel up in the air for want of wind.' And blew for him. It was the wittiest thing. I didn't smoke it entirely all at once, however, only after I'd been pumping for some time, and then I could hardly keep from laughing aloud. It may be that post-captains are a very witty set of men and that I'm coming to it. But then you very nearly lost your patient. Like a fool, I strayed out of bounds. A little chap heaves in sight, sings out, 'Captain A,' and I say,
This claps a stopper over all, Jack. You're brought by the lee. But, however, it was orders to join the Lively. She's only a temporary command, and, of course, as acting captain, I don't take my friends with me. But I do beg you, my dear Stephen, to sail with me as my guest. The Pollycrests will be paid off. Parker is to have the Fanchula in compliment to me, which is as cruel a kindness as the world has seen since that fellow in the play. But I've looked after the Pollycrests' people, so there will be no difficulty of any kind. Pray come. I cannot tell you what pleasure it would give me, and to be even more egotistical in what I am afraid is a sadly egotistical letter, let me say that, having had your care, I should never trust my frame to a common sore bones again. My health is far from good, Stephen. She's a crack frigate with a good reputation, and I believe we shall have orders for the West Indies. Think of the bonitos, the bosun birds, the turtles, the palm trees. I'm sending Killick with this. Heartily glad I am to be shot of him, too. Such a pragmatical brute he's grown with his physic spoon. And he'll see our dunnage round to the Nore. I'm dining with Lord Melville on Sunday. Robert will run me down in his curricle, and I shall sneak aboard that night without touching at an inn. Then I swear to God I shall not set foot ashore until I can do so without this wretched fear of being taken to a sponging house and then to a debtor's prison. Yours, most affectionately. Killick, he shouted. Sir, are you sober? As a judge, sir. Then pack my shore-going trunk, all but my uniform and number one scraper. Take it down to the Nore, aboard the Lively, and give the first lieutenant this chit. We join her on Sunday night, temporary command. Then proceed to the Downs. Give this letter to the doctor, and this to Mr. Parker. It has good news for him, so give it into his hands yourself. If the doctor chooses to join the Lively, take his sea chest and anything else he wants, no matter what, a stuffed whale or a double-headed ape got with child by the bosun. My sea chest, of course, and what we saved from the Pollycrest. Repeat your instructions. Good. Here is what you'll need for the journey, and here is 5 shillings for a decent glazed hat. You may skim the other into the Thames. I will not have you go aboard the Lively without a Christian covering to your head. And get yourself a new jacket while you're about it. She's a crack frigate. She was a crack frigate. She was indeed. And seeing that a wheel came off Robert's curricle in a remote and midnight ditch, Jack was obliged to go aboard her in the glare of the risen sun, passing through the crowded streets of Chatham. A considerable trial to him after an already trying night. But this was nothing to the trial of meeting Dr. Maturin on the water, for Stephen had been inspired to put off from the shore at about the same time, though from a different place. And their courses converged some 3 furlongs from the frigate's side. Stephen's conveyance was one of the Lively's cutters, which saluted Jack by tossing oars, and which fell under his wherry's lee, so that they pulled in close company, Stephen calling out pleasantly all the way. Jack caught a frightened glance from Killick, noticed the wooden composure of the midshipman and the cutter's crew, saw the grinning face of Matthew Paris, an old Pollycrest, Stephen's servant, once a framework knitter and still no kind of seaman, no notion of common propriety in his myopic, friendly gaze. And as Stephen rose to wave and hoot, Jack saw that he was dressed from head to foot in a single, tight, dull brown garment. It clung to him, and his pale, delighted face emerged from a woollen roll at the top, looking unnaturally large. His general appearance was something between that of an attenuated ape and a meagre hart, and he was carrying his narwhal horn. Captain Aubrey's back and shoulders went perfectly rigid. He adopted the features of one who is smiling. He even called out, "Good morning to you. Yes. No. Ha-ha.
and as he recomposed them to a look of immovable gravity and unconcern, the thought darted through his mind, I believe the wicked old creature's drunk. Up and up the side, a long haul after the Polycrest, the wailing of the calls, the stamp and clash of the marines presenting arms, and he was aboard. Mathematical precision, rigorous exactitude, fore and aft. He'd rarely seen a more splendid array of blue and gold on the quarterdeck. Even the midshipmen were in cocked hats and snowy breeches. The officers stood motionless, bareheaded. The naval lieutenants, the marine lieutenants, then the master, the surgeon, the purser, and a couple of black coats, chaplain and schoolmaster, no doubt, and then the flock of young gentlemen, one of whom, 3 feet tall and 5 years of age, had his thumb in his mouth. A comfortably jarring note in all this perfection of gold lace, ivory deck, ebony seams. Jack moved his hat to the quarterdeck, tilting it no more than an inch or so because of his bandage. "We got a rogue," whispered the captain of the foretop. "A proud son of Rolf, mate," replied the yeoman of the sheets. The first lieutenant stepped forward, a grave, severe, tall, thin man. "Welcome aboard, sir," said he. "My name is Simmons." "Thank you, Mr. Simmons. Gentlemen, good morning to you. Mr. Simmons, pray be so good as to name the officers." Bows, civil mutterings. They were youngish men, except for the purser and the chaplain, and a pleasant-looking set, but reserved and politely distant. "Very well," said Jack to the first lieutenant. "We will muster the ship's company at 6 bells, if you please, and I shall read myself in then." Leaning over the side, he called, "Dr. Maturin, will you not come aboard?" Stephen was no more of a mariner now than he had been at the outset of his naval career, and it took him a long moment to clamber snorting up the frigate's side, propped by the agonised Killick, a moment that increased the attentive quarterdeck's sense of expectation. "Mr. Simmons," said Jack, fixing him with a hard, savage eye, "this is my friend, Dr. Maturin, who will be accompanying me. Dr. Maturin, Mr. Simmons, the first lieutenant of the Lively."
"Your servant, sir," said Stephen, making a leg.
And this, thought Jack, was perhaps the most hideous action that a person in so subhuman a garment could perform. Hitherto the Lively's quarterdeck had taken the apparition nobly with a vexing remote perfection. But now, as Mr. Simmons bowed stiffly, saying, "Servant, sir," and as Stephen, by way of being amiable, said, "What a splendid vessel, to be sure! Vast, spacious decks! One might almost imagine oneself aboard an Indiaman!" There was a wild shriek of childish laughter, a quickly smothered shriek, followed by a howl that vanished sobbing down the companion ladder. "Perhaps you would like to come into the cabin," said Jack, taking Stephen's elbow in an iron grip. "Your things will be brought aboard directly, never trouble yourself." Stephen cast a look into the boat and seemed about to break away. "I shall see to it myself at once, sir," said the first lieutenant. "Oh, Mr. Simmons," cried Stephen, "pray bid them be very tender of my bees."
"Certainly, sir," said the first lieutenant with a civil inclination of his head.
Jack got him into the after cabin at last, a finely proportioned, bare, spacious cabin, with a great gun on either side and little else but the splendid curving breadth of the stern windows. Hammond was clearly no sybarite. Here he sat on a locker and gazed at Stephen's garment. It had been horrible at a distance. It was worse near too, far worse. "Stephen," he said. "I say, Stephen, come in," It was Paris, with a rectangular sailcloth parcel. Stephen ran to him, took it from his arms with infinite precaution, and set it on the table, pressing his ear to its side. "Listen, Jack," he said, smiling. "Put your ear firmly to the top and listen while I tap." The parcel gave a sudden, momentary hum. "Did you hear? That shows they are queen right, that no harm has come to their queen. But we must open it at once. They must have air. There. A glass hive. Is it not ingenious, charming? I've always wanted to keep bees." "But how in God's name do you expect to keep bees in a man of war?" cried Jack. "Where in God's name do you expect them to find flowers at sea? How would they eat?" "You can see their every motion," said Stephen, close against the glass, entranced. "Oh, as for their feeding, never fret your anxious mind. They will feed with us, upon a saucer of sugar at stated intervals. If the ingenious Monsieur Aubert can keep bees, and he blind, the poor man, surely we can manage in a great, spacious seabeck." "This is a frigate. Let us never split hairs, for all love. There's the Queen. Come, look at the Queen." "How many of these reptiles might there be?" asked Jack, holding pretty much aloof. "Oh, 60,000 or so, I dare say," said Stephen carelessly. "And when it comes on to blow, we'll ship gimbals for the hive. This will preserve them from undue lateral motion." "You think of almost everything," said Jack. "Well, I will wear the bees like Damon and Pythagoras. Oh, a mere 60,000 bees in the cabin don't signify much. But I tell you what it is, Stephen, you don't always think of quite everything." "You refer to the Queen's being a virgin," said Stephen. "Not really, no. What I really meant was that this is a crack frigate." "I'm delighted to hear it. There she goes. She lays an egg. You needn't fear for her virginity, Jack. And in this frigate they are very particular. Did not you remark the show of uniforms as you came aboard? An admiral's inspection, a royal review?" "No, I cannot truthfully say that I did. Tell me, brother, is there some uneasiness on your mind?" "Stephen, will you, for the love of God, take off that thing?" "My wool garment. You have noticed it, have you? I had forgot, or I should have pointed it out. Have you ever seen anything so deeply rational? See, I can withdraw my head entirely. The same applies to the feet and the hands. Warm, yet uncumbering. Light, and above all healthy. No constriction anywhere. Paris, who was once a framework knitter, made it to my design. He's working on one for you at present. Stephen, you would favour me deeply by taking it right off. It is unphilosophical of me, I know, but this is only an acting command, and I cannot afford to be laughed at." "But you have often told me that it doesn't matter what one wears at sea. You yourself appeared in nankeen trousers, a thing that I should never, never countenance. And this," plucking at his bosom with a disappointed air, "partakes of the nature both of the Guernsey frock and of the free and easy pantaloon." The Lively had remained in commission throughout the piece. Her people had been together many years, with few changes among the officers, and they had their own way of doing things. All ships were, to some degree, separate kingdoms, with different customs and a different atmosphere. This was particularly true of those that were on detached service, or much by themselves, far from their admirals and the rest of the fleet. And the Lively had been in the East Indies for years on end. It was on her return, during the first days of the renewed war, that she had had her luck. 2 French Indiamen in the same day off Finisterre. When she was paid off, Captain Hammond had no difficulty in manning her again, for most of his people re-entered, and he even had the luxury of turning volunteers away. Jack had met him once or twice,
A quiet, thoughtful, unhumorous, unimaginative man in his 40s, prematurely grey, devoted to hydrography and the physics of sailing, somewhat old for a frigate captain. And as he had met him in the company of Lord Cochrane, he had seemed rather to want colour in comparison with that ebullient nobleman. His first impression of the lively didn't alter during the ceremonies of mustering and quarters. She was obviously a most competent ship with a highly efficient crew of right man-o-war's men. Probably a happy ship in her quiet way, judging from the men's demeanour and those countless very small signs that a searching professional eye could see. Happy yet taut. A great distance between officers and men. But as he and Stephen were sitting in the dining room waiting for their supper, he wondered how she had come by her reputation as a crack frigate. It was certainly not from her appearance, for although everything aboard was unexceptionally shipshape and man-o-war fashion, there was no extraordinary show of perfection. Indeed, nothing extraordinary at all, apart from her huge yards and her white manila cordage. Her hull and port lids were painted dull grey with an ochre streak for the gun tier. Her 38 guns were chocolate-coloured, and the only obvious piece of brass was her bell, which shone like burnished gold. Nor was it from her fighting qualities, since, from no fault of her own, she had seen no action with anything approaching a match for her long 18-pounders. Perhaps it was from her remarkable state of readiness. She was permanently cleared for action, or very nearly so. When the drum beat for quarters, she might almost have gone straight into battle, apart from a few bulkheads and a minimum of furniture. The two quarter-deck goats walked straight down the ladder by themselves, the hen-coops vanished on an ingenious slide, and the guns in his own cabins were cast loose, something he had never seen before in an exercise. She had a Spartan air, but that in itself was not enough to explain anything, although it didn't arise from poverty. The lively was well-to-do. Her captain had recently bought himself a seat in Parliament. Her officers were men of private means, even before their fortunate stroke, and Hammond insisted upon a handsome allowance from the parents of his midshipmen. "Stephen," he said, "how are your bees?"
"They're very well, I thank you. They show great activity, even enthusiasm. But," he added with a slight hesitation, "I seem to detect a certain reluctance to return to their hive."
"Do you mean to say you let them out?" cried Jack. "Do you mean that there are 60,000 bees howling for blood in the cabin?"
"No, no, oh no. Not above half that number, perhaps even less. And if you don't provoke them, I'm persuaded you may go to and fro without the least concern. They're not froward bees. They will have gone home by morning. Sure, I shall creep in during the middle watch and close their little wicket. But perhaps it might be as well were we to sit together in this room tonight, just to let them get used to their surroundings. A certain initial agitation is understandable after all, and should not be discountenanced."
Jack was not a bee, however, and his initial agitation was something else again. It was clear to him that the lively was a closed, self-sufficing community, an entity to which he was an outsider. He'd served under acting captains himself, and he knew that they could be regarded as intruders, that they could excite resentment if they took too much upon themselves. They had great powers, certainly, but they were wise not to use them. Yet, on the other hand, he might have to fight this ship. The ultimate responsibility, the loss of reputation or its gain, was his. And although he was here only for the time, and although he was not the real owner, he was not going to play King Log. He must move with care, and at the same time with decision. A difficult passage. An awkward first lieutenant could prove the very devil. By the grace of God, he had a little money in hand. He would be able to entertain them decently for the present,
although he couldn't keep Hammond's table, with half a dozen to dinner every day. He must hope for another advance from his agent soon, but for the moment he wouldn't look poverty-stricken. There was a Latin tag about poverty and ridicule. Elusive. No hand at Latin. He must not be ridiculous. No captain could afford to be ridiculous. Stephen. Oh, my dear fellow, he said to the telltale compass over his cot, for he was in his sleeping cabin. What induced you to put on that vile thing? What a singular genius you have for hiding your talent under a bushel. A bushel that no one could possibly have foreseen. In the gun room, however, another sound of things was heard. No, gentlemen, said Mr. Flores, the surgeon. I do assure you he is a great man. I've read his book until it is dog-eared. A most luminous exposition, full of pregnant reflections, a mine of nervous expressions. When the physician of the fleet came to inspect us, he asked me whether I'd read it, and I was happy to show him my copy, interleaved and annotated, and to tell him that I required my assistance to get whole passages by heart. I tell you, I long to be introduced to him. I long for his opinion on poor Wallace. The gun room was impressed. It had a deep respect for learning, and but for that unfortunate remark about East Indiamen, it would have been ready to accept the wool garment as a philosopher's vagary, a knitted Diogenes tub. Yet, if he has been in the service, said Mr. Simmons, what are we to make of his remark about the East Indiaman? It was very like a direct affront, and it was delivered with a strangely knowing leer. Mr. Flores looked at his plate, but found no justification there. The chaplain coughed and said that perhaps they should not judge by appearances. Perhaps the gentleman had had a momentary absence. Perhaps he meant that the Indiaman was the very type of sea-going luxury, which indeed it was. A well-appointed Indiaman was to be preferred in point of comfort to a first-rate. That makes it worse, observed the third lieutenant, an ascetic young man so tall and thin that it was difficult to see where he could sleep at length, if not in the cable tier. Well, for my part, said the senior marine, the caterer to the mess, I shall drink to his health and eternal happiness in a glass of this excellent Margot, as sound as a nut, whatever the parson may say. Such an example of courage as coming aboard like Badger Bag with a narwhal horn in one hand and a green umbrella in the other has never come under my observation. Bless him! The gunroom blessed him, but without much conviction, except for Mr. Flores, and they went on to discuss the health of Cassandra, the last of the Lively's Gibbons, the last of that numerous menagerie which she had borne away from Java and the remoter islands of the Eastern Seas. They didn't discuss their acting captain at all. He'd come with the reputation of a seaman and a fighter, of a rake and of a protégé of Lord Melville. Captain Hammond was a supporter of Lord St. Vincent, and he'd gone to Parliament to vote with St. Vincent's friends. And Lord St. Vincent, who hated Pitt and his administration, was working to impeach Lord Melville for malversation of the secret funds and to get him out of the Admiralty. The Lively's officers all shared their captain's views. Strong Whigs to a man. Breakfast was something of a disappointment. Captain Hammond had always drunk cocoa, originally to encourage the crew to do the same, and then because he liked it, whereas Jack and Stephen were neither of them human until the first pot of coffee was down, hot and strong. Killick, said Jack, toss this hogswash over the side and bring coffee at once.
Ask pardon, sir,
said Killick, seriously alarmed. "I forgot the beans and the cook's got none."
"Then jump to the purser's steward or the gunroom cook, the sick bay, anywhere, and get some, or your name will not be preserved much longer, I can tell you. Cut along, goddamn lubber, to forget our coffee," he said to Stephen with warm indignation.
"A little pause will make it all the more welcome when it comes, sure," said Stephen. And to divert his friend's mind, he took up a bee and said, "Be so good as to watch my honey bee."
He put it down on the edge of a saucer in which he had made a syrup of cocoa and sugar. The bee tasted to the syrup, pumped a reasonable quantity, took to the air, hovered before the saucer, and returned to the hive.
"Now, sir," said Stephen, noting the time on his watch, "now you will behold a prodigy." In 25 seconds, two bees appeared, questing over the saucer with a particular high, shrill buzz. They pitched, pumped syrup, and went home. After the same interval, 4 bees came. Then 16, then 256. But when 4 minutes had elapsed, this simple progression was obscured by earlier bees who knew the way and who no longer had to fix either their hive or the syrup.
"Now," cried Stephen from out of the cloud, "have you any doubt of their power to communicate a locus? How do they do it? What is their signal? Is it a compass bearing? Jack, don't offer to molest that bee, I beg. For shame, it's only resting."
"Beg pardon, sir, but there ain't a drop of coffee in the bark.
Yo, God almighty," said Killick.
"Stephen, I'm going to take a turn," said Jack, withdrawing from the table in a sly, undulatory motion and darting through the door with hunched shoulders.
"Why call this a crack frigate?" he said, swilling down a glass of water in his sleeping cabin. "I cannot for the life of me imagine. Not a drop of coffee among 260 men." The reason became apparent to him some 2 hours later when the port admiral signalled, "Lively, proceed to sea."
"Acknowledge," said Jack, this news being brought to him. "Mr. Simmons, we will unmoor, if you please."
The unmooring was a pleasure to watch. At the pipe of all hands to unmoor ship, the men flowed rather than ran to their stations. There was no stampede along the gangways, no stream of men blundering into one another in their haste to escape the rope's end. As far as he could see, there was no starting, and there was certainly very little noise. The capstan bars were pinned and swifted. The marines and afterguard manned them. The piercing fife struck up drops of brandy, and one cable came in while the other went out. A midshipman from the forecastle reported, "The best bower catted." The first lieutenant relayed this to Jack, who said, "Carry on, Mr. Simmons." Now the Lively was at single anchor. And as the capstan turned again, so she crept across the sea until she was immediately over it.
"Up and down, sir," called the bosun.
"Up and down, sir," said the first lieutenant to Jack.
"Carry on, Mr. Simmons," said Jack.
This was the crucial moment. The crew had both to clap on fresh nippers, the bands that attached the great cable to the messenger, the rope that actually turned on the capstan, for a firmer hold, and to loose the topsails so as to sail the anchor out of the ground. In even the best-managed ships there was a good deal of hullabaloo at such a time, and in this case, with the tide running across the wind, an awkward cast in which split-second timing was called for, he expected a rapid volley, a broadside of orders. Mr. Simmons advanced to the break of the quarterdeck, glancing quickly up and down, said, "Thick and dry for weighing." And then, before the rush of feet had died away, "Make sail!" No more. Instantly, the shrouds were dark with men racing aloft. Her topsails, her deep,
very well cut topsails were let fall in silence, sheeted home, the yards hoisted up, and the Lively, surging forward, weighed her anchor without a word. But this wasn't all. Even before the small bower was fished, the jib, forestaysail, and foretogallant had appeared, and the frigate was moving faster and faster through the water, heading almost straight for the Nore Light. All this without a word, without a cry except for an unearthly hooting of woe, 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 high in the upper rigging. Jack had never seen anything like it. In his astonishment, he looked up at the main topgallant yard, and there he saw a small form hanging by one arm. It swung itself forward on the roll of the ship and fell in a sickening curve towards the main topmast stay. Almost unbelievably, it caught this rope, and then, altogether unbelievably, shot up from one piece of rigging to another to the fore royal and sat there. "That's Cassandra, sir," said Mr. Simmons, seeing Jack's face of horror. "A sort of Java ape."
"God help us," said Jack, recovering himself. "I thought it was the ship's boy gone mad. I've never seen anything like it. This manoeuvre, I mean. Do your people usually make sail according to their own notions?"
"Yes, sir," said the First Lieutenant in civil triumph.
"Well, very well. The Lively has her own way of doing things, I see. I've never seen..."
The frigate was heeling to the breeze, marvellously alive, and he stepped to the taffrail where Stephen, dressed in a sad-coloured coat and drab small clothes, stood conversing with Mr. Randall, bending to hear his tiny pipe. Jack looked at the dark water slipping fast by her side, curving deep under her chains. She was making 7 knots already, 7 and a half. He looked at her wake, fixing an anchored 74 in a church tower. Hardly a trace of leeway. He leant over the larboard quarter, and there, one point on the larboard bow, was the Nore Light. The wind was 2.3 on the starboard tack, and any ship he'd sailed in would be aground in the next 5 minutes. "You're happy about your course, Mr. Simmons?" he said.
"Quite happy, sir,"
said the First Lieutenant.
Simmons knew his ship, that was obvious. He most certainly knew her capabilities. Jack repeated this. He was convinced of it, it must be so. But the next 5 minutes were as unhappy as any he had ever spent. This beautiful, beautiful ship, a mere hulk, dismasted, bilged.
During the moments when the Lively was racing through the turbid, shoaling water at the edge of the bank, and where a trifle of leeway would wreck her hopelessly, he didn't breathe at all. Then the bank was astern. With as much impassivity as he could summon, he drew in the good sparkling air and desired Mr. Simmons to set course for the Downs, where he was to pick up some supernumeraries, and, if Bondon had not vanished, his own coxswain, seeing that Captain Hammond had taken his with him to London. He set to pacing the windward side of the quarterdeck, keenly watching the behaviour of the Lively and her crew. No wonder they called her a crack frigate. Her sailing qualities were quite out of the ordinary, and the smooth, quiet discipline of her people was beyond anything he'd seen. Her speed in getting underway and making sail had something unnatural about it, as eerie as the cry of the gibbon in the rigging. The familiar, low, grey, muddy shores glided by. The sea was a hard, metallic grey. The horizon in the offing ruled sharply from the mottled sky, and the frigate ran on, the wind, now 1.3, as though a precise, undeviating rail were guiding her. Merchantmen were coming in for the London River,
4 sail of Guinea men, and a brig of war for Chatham, apart from the usual hovelers and peterboats. How flabby and loose they looked by comparison. The fact of the matter was that Captain Hammond, a gentleman of a scientific turn of mind, had chosen his officers with great care, and he'd spent years training his crew. Even the waisters could hand reef and steer, and for the first years he'd raced them mast against mast in furling and loosing sail, putting them through every manoeuvre and combination of manoeuvres until they reached equality at a speed that could not be improved upon. And today, jealous for the honour of their ship, they had excelled themselves. They knew it very well. And as they passed near their acting captain, they glanced at him with discreet complacency, as who would say, "We showed you a thing or two, cock. We made you stretch your eyes." What a ship to fight, he reflected. If he met one of the big French frigates, he could make rings round her, beautifully built though they were. Yes. But what of the Livelys themselves? They were seamen, to be sure, quite remarkable seamen. But were they not a little elderly on the whole, oddly quiet? Even the ship's boys were stout, hairy fellows, rather heavy for lying out on the royal yards. And most of them talked gruff. Then there were a good many brown and yellow men aboard. Lowbum, who was now at the wheel, steering wonderfully small, had had no need to grow a pigtail when he entered at Macau. Nor had John Satisfaction, Horatio Jellybelly, or half a dozen of his shipmates. Were they fighting men? The Livelys had had none of the incessant cutting-out expeditions that made danger an everyday affair and so disarmed it. Circumstances had been entirely different. He should have read her log to see exactly what she had done. His eye fell on one of the quarter-deck carronades. It was painted brown, and some of the dull, scrubbed paint overlapped the touch-hole. It hadn't been fired for a long while. Certainly he should look at the log to see how the Livelys spent their day. On the leeward side, Mr. Randall told Stephen that his mother was dead, and that they had a tortoise at home. He hoped the tortoise didn't miss him. Was it really true that the Chinese never ate bread and butter? Never, at any time whatsoever? He and Old Smith messed with the gunner, and Mrs. Armstrong was very kind to them. Plucking at Stephen's hand to draw his attention, he said in his clear pipe, "Do you think the new captain will flog George Rogers, sir?"
"I cannot tell, my dear. I hope not, I'm sure."
"Oh, I hope he does," cried the child with a skip. "I've never seen a man flogged. Have you ever seen a man flogged, sir?"
"Yes," said Stephen.
"Was there a great deal of blood, sir?"
"Indeed there was," said Stephen. 6 buckets full."
Mr. Randall skipped again and asked whether it would be long to 6 bells. "George Rogers was in a horrid passion, sir," he added. "He called Joe Brown a Dutch galliot-built bugger and damned his eyes 2. I heard him. Should you like to hear me recite the points of the compass without a pause, sir? There's my papa beckoning. Goodbye, sir."
"Sir," said the First Lieutenant, stepping across to Jack, "I must beg your pardon, but there are 2 things I forgot to mention. Captain Hammond indulged the young gentleman with the use of his forecabin in the mornings for their lessons with the schoolmaster. Should you wish to continue the custom?"
"Certainly, Mr. Simmons, a capital notion."
"Thank you, sir. And the other thing was that we usually punish on Mondays in the Lively."
"On Mondays? How curious."
"Yes, sir. Captain Hammond thought it was well to let defaulters have Sunday for quiet reflection."
"Well, well, let it be so, then. I'd meant to ask you what the ship's general policy is with regard to punishment. I do not like to make any sudden changes, but I must warn you I'm no great friend to the cat."
Simmons smiled.
"Nor is Captain Hammond, sir. Our usual punishment is pumping. We open a seacock, let clean water in to mix with what's in the bilges, and pump it out again.
It keeps the ship sweet. We rarely flog. In the Indian Ocean, we were nearly 2 years without bringing the cat out of its bag. And since then, not above once in 2 or 3 months. But I'm afraid that today you may think it necessary, an unpleasant case. Not Article 39. No, sir. Theft. Theft, it was said to be. Authority, speaking hoarse and official through the mouth of the master-at-arms, said it was theft, riotous conduct and resisting arrest. With the ship's company assembled aft, the marines drawn up, and all the officers present, he led his victim before the captain and said, "Did steal one ape's head." "It's all lies," cried George Rogers, still clearly in a horrid passion. "The property of Evan Evans' quarter gunner. It's all lies." And being desired to step aft, "It's all lies, lies," cried Rogers. "Silence there," said Jack. "You shall have your turn, Rogers. Carry on, Brown." "And on being told I had information that led me to believe he was in possession of this head, and on being desired civil to step aft and verify the statements of Evan Evans' quarter gunner larboard watch," said the master-at-arms, swivelling his eyes alone in the direction of Rogers, "did call out expressions of contempt, was in liquor, and endeavoured to conceal himself in the sail-room. All lies! And when roused out, did offer violence to Button, Menhasset, and Mutton, able seamen." "It's all lies!" cried Rogers, beside himself with indignation. "All lies!" "Well, what did happen?" said Jack. "Tell me in your own words." "I will, Your Honour," said Rogers, glaring round, pale and trembling with fury. "In my own gospel words. Master-at-arms comes forward, which I was taking a cork, my watch below, tips me a shove on the arse, begging your pardon, and says, 'Get your skates on, George, you're fucked.' And I up and I says, 'I don't care for you, Joe Brown, nor that fucking little cunt Evans.' No offence, Your Honour, but that's the gospel truth, to show Your Honour the lies he tells, with his verified statements. It's all lies." There seemed to be a more familiar ring about this version, but it was followed by a rambling account of who pushed whom in what part of the ship, with contradictory evidence from Button, Menhasset and Mutton, and remarks on character. And it seemed that the main issue might be lost in a discussion of who lent someone $2 off of Banda and was never repaid in grog, tobacco or any other form. "What about this ape's head?" said Jack. "Here, sir," said the master-at-arms, producing a hairy thing from his bosom. "You say it's yours, Evans, and you say it's yours, Rogers. Your own property."
"She's my Andrew Masher, Your Honour," said Evans.
"He's my poor old Ajax, sir, been in my ditty bag ever since he took sick off the Cape." "How can you identify it, Evans?"
"An answer? How do you know it's your Andrew Masher?" "By your loving expression, sir, Your Honour. By your expressions. Griffey Jones' stuffed animal's Dover's giving me a guinea for it tomorrow. Yes, yes."
"What have you to say, Rogers?"
"It's all lies, sir," cried Rogers. "He's my Ajax, which I fed him from Kampong, shared my grog, ate biscuit like a Christian."
"Any distinguishing marks?"
"Why, the cut of his jib, sir. I know him anywhere's, though shrivelled."
Jack studied the ape's face, which was set in an expression of deep melancholy contempt. Who was telling the truth? Both thought they were, no doubt. There had been two apes' heads in the ship, and now there was only one. Though how anyone could pretend to recognise the features of this wizened red coconut heavy in his hand, he couldn't tell. "Andrew Masher was a female, I take it, and Ajax a male," he said.
"That's right, Your Honour."
"Beg Dr. Maturin to come on deck if he's not engaged," said Jack. "Dr. Maturin, is it possible to tell the sex of an ape by its teeth, or that kind of thing?"
"Oh, it depends on the ape," said Stephen, looking eagerly at the object in Jack's hand. "This, for example," he said, taking it and turning it about, "is an
excellent specimen of the male Simia satyrus, Boffin's wild man of the woods. See the lateral expansion of the cheeks mentioned by Hunter, and the remains of that particular throat sac so characteristic of the male.
Well, there you are, said Jack. Ajax it is.
Thank you very much, Doctor. The charge of theft is dismissed, but you must not knock people about, Rogers. Has anyone something to say in his favour?
The second lieutenant stepped forward, said that Rogers was in his division, attentive to his duty, generally sober, a good character, but apt to fly into a passion. Jack told Rogers that he must not fly into a passion. That flying into a passion was a very bad thing. It would certainly lead him to the gallows if indulged in. He was to command his temper and do without grog for the next week. The head was confiscated temporarily for further examination. Indeed, it had already vanished into the cabin, leaving Rogers looking somewhat blank.
I dare say you'll get it back in time, said Jack with more conviction than he felt. The other defaulters, all guilty of uncomplicated drunkenness, were all dealt with in the same way. The grating was unrigged. The cat, still in its bag, returned to its resting place. And shortly after, the hands were piped to dinner. Jack invited the first lieutenant, the officer and midshipman of the watch, and the chaplain to dine with him, and resumed his pacing. His thoughts ran on gunnery. There were ships, and plenty of them, that hardly ever exercised the great guns, hardly fired them except in action or for saluting, and if this was the case with the Lively, he would change it. Even at close quarters it was as well to hit where it hurt most, and in a typical frigate action, accuracy and speed were everything. Yet this was not the Sophie with her popguns. A single broadside from the Lively would burn well over 100 weight of powder. A consideration. Dear Sophie, how she blazed away. He identified the music that was running so insistently through his head. It was a piece of Hummel's that he and Stephen had played so often at Melbury Lodge, the Adagio. And almost at once he had the clearest visual image of Sophia, standing tall and willowy by the piano, looking confused, hanging her head. He turned short in his stride and brought his mind to bear strongly on the question in hand. But it was no use. The music wove in among his calculations of powder and shot. He grew more agitated and unhappy, and clapping his hands together with a sudden report, he said to himself, "I shall run through the log and see what their practice really is. Tell Killick to uncork the claret." He didn't forget that, at all events. He went below, noticed the smell of midshipmen in the fore cabin, walked through into the after cabin, and found himself in total darkness. "Close the door," cried Stephen, swarming past him and clapping it to. "What's amiss?" asked Jack, whose mind had moved so deep into naval life that he'd forgotten the bees, as he might have forgotten even a vivid nightmare. They are remarkably adaptable, perhaps the most adaptable of all social insects, said Stephen from another part of the cabin. "We find them from Norway to the burning wastes of the Sahara, but they've not grown quite used to their surroundings yet." "Oh, God," said Jack, scrabbling for the handle. "Are they all out?"
"Not all," said Stephen. "And learning from Killick that you expected guests, I conceived you might prefer them away. There's so much ignorant prejudice against bees in a dining room." Something was crawling on Jack's neck. The door had completely vanished. He began to sweat heavily.
"So I thought to create an artificial night when, in the course of nature, they return to their hive. I also made 3 fires for the sake of the smoke. These did not have the desired effect, however. It may be that the darkness is too complete. Let's compromise with the twilight. Dark, but not too dark." He raised a corner of sailcloth, and a beam of sun showed an
incalculable number of bees on every vertical surface, and on most of those that were flat. Bees flying in a jerky, meaningless fashion from point to point, 50 or so sitting on his coat and breeches.
"There," said Stephen. "That is far, far better, is it not? Urge them to mount on your finger, Jack, and carry them back to their hive. Gently, gently. And on no account exhibit or even feel the least uneasiness. Fear is wholly fatal, as I dare say you know."
Jack had the door handle. He opened it a crack and glided swiftly through.
"Killick!" he shouted, beating at his clothes.
"Sir, go and help the doctor. Bear a hand now."
"I dursn't," said Killick.
"You don't mean to tell me you're afraid, a man of war's man?"
"Yes, I am, sir," said Killick.
"Well, clear the fore cabin and lay the cloth there, and uncork a dozen of claret." He plunged into his sleeping cabin and tore off his stock. There was something creeping beneath it. "What is there for dinner?" he called.
"Venison, sir. I found a prime saddle at Chater's, the same as the lady sent us from Mapes."
"Gentlemen," said Jack, as the last stroke of six bells in the afternoon watch was struck and his guests arrived, "you're very welcome. I'm afraid we may have to sit a little close, but for the moment my friend is engaged in a philosophical experiment aft. Killick, tell the doctor we hope to see him when he is at leisure."
"Go on," he muttered, clenching his fist secretly and vibrating his head at the steward. "Go on, I say. You can call through the door."
Dinner ran very well. The Lively might be Spartan in her appearance and cabin furniture, but Jack had inherited an excellent cook accustomed to seaborne appetites, and his guests were well-bred men, easy within the strict limits of naval etiquette. Even the midshipman of the watch, though mute, was mute gracefully. But the sense of rank, of deference to the captain, was very strong. And as Stephen's mind was clearly far away, Jack was pleased to find in the chaplain a lively, conversable man with little notions of the solemnities of dining in the cabin. Mr. Lydgate, the perpetual curate of Wool, was a cousin of Captain Hammond's, and he was taking this voyage for the sake of his health, leaving his living not for a new career, but for a temporary change of air and scenery. The air of Lisbon and Madeira was particularly recommended, that of Bermuda even more so, and this, he understood, was their destination?
"It may well be," said Jack. "I hope so, indeed. But with the changing face of the war, there's no certainty about these things. I've known captains lay in stores for the Cape only to find themselves ordered to the Baltic at the last moment. Everything must depend on the good of the service," he added piously. And then, feeling that remarks of this kind might have a damping effect, he cried, "Mr. Dashwood, the wine stands by you. The good of the service requires that it should circulate. Mr. Simmons, pray tell me about the ape that so astonished me this morning, the living ape."
"Cassandra, sir? She's one of half a dozen that came aboard at Tungu. The surgeon says she is a Tenasserim gibbon. All hands are very fond of her, but we're afraid she's pining. We rigged her out in a flannel jacket when we came into the chops of the Channel, but she'll not wear it, and she will not eat English food. Do you hear, Stephen? There's a gibbon aboard that isn't well."
"Yes, yes," said Stephen, returning to the present. "I had the pleasure of meeting her this morning, walking hand in hand with the very young gentleman. It was impossible to tell which was supporting which. A fetching, attractive creature, in spite of its deplorable state. I look forward eagerly to dissecting it. Monsieur de Buffon hints that the naked callosities on the buttocks of the hylobates may conceal scent glands, but he doesn't go so far as to assert it."
A chill fell on the conversation, and after a slight pause, Jack said, "I think, my dear fellow, that the ship's company would be infinitely more obliged to you was you to cure it than for putting Monsieur de Buffon right.
for putting Cassandra in order rather than a Frenchman, eh? Yet it is the ship's company that is killing her. That ape is a confirmed alcoholic. And from what little I know of your foremast, Jack, no earthly consideration will prevent him from giving rum to anything he loves. Our monk seal in the Mediterranean, for example. It drowned in a state of besotted inebriation with a fixed smile upon its face, and when fished up and dissected, its kidneys and liver were found to be ruined. Very much like those of Mr. Blankley of the Carcass Bomb Catch, an unpromoted master's mate of 63 whom I had the pleasure of opening at Port Mahon, a gentleman who had not been sober for 35 years. I met this Gibbon a little after the serving out of the grog. It had plunged from an upper pinnacle at the first notes of Nancy Dawson, and the animal was hopelessly fuddled, but was conscious of its state, endeavoured to conceal it, and put its black hand in mine with an embarrassed air. Who is that very young gentleman, by the way? He was Josiah Randall, they told him, the son of the second lieutenant, who had come home to find his wife dead, and this child unprovided for. No near family at all. So he brought him aboard, said Mr. Dashwood, and the captain rated him bosun's servant. How very, very painful, said Jack. I hope we have some action soon. There's nothing like it for changing the current of a man's mind. A French frigate or a Spaniard, if they come in. There's nothing like a Spaniard for dogged fighting. I dare say you've seen a great deal of action, sir, said the parson, nodding towards Jack's bandage. Not more than most, sir, said Jack. Many officers have been far more fortunate. Pray, what would you consider a reasonable number of actions? Asked the parson. I was astonished on joining the ship to find that none of the gentlemen could tell me what a pitched battle was like. It's so much a question of luck, or perhaps I should say of providence, said Jack, with a bow to the cloth, where one is stationed and so on. After all, he said, pausing, for on the verge of his mind there was a witticism, if he could but grasp it, after all, it takes two to make a quarrel. And if the French don't come out, why, you cannot very well have a battle all by yourself. Indeed, there is so much routine work, blockading and convoy duty and carrying troops, you know, that I dare say half the lieutenants of the Navy List have never seen action at all, in the sense of a meeting of ships of equal force or of fleets, more than half, perhaps. I never have, I'm sure, said Dashwood. I saw an action when I was in the Culloden in 98, said Simmons. A very great action, but we ran aground and never could come up. It nearly broke our hearts. It must have been a sad trial, said Jack. I remember how you carried out warps, pulling like heroes. You were at the Nile, sir? Yes, yes, I was in the Leander. I remember coming on deck just as the Moutine rounded to under your stern to try to heave you off. So you were in a great battle, Captain Aubrey, said the chaplain eagerly. Pray, can you tell me what it was like? Can you give me some impression of it? Why, sir, I doubt that I could really, any more than I could give you much impression of, let's say, a symphony or a splendid dinner. There's a great deal of noise, more noise than you would believe possible, and time doesn't seem to have the same meaning, if you follow me, and you get very tired, and afterwards you have to clear up the mess. Ah, that's what I wanted to know. And is the din so very great? It's enormous. At the Nile, for example, we had the Orion blown up near us, and we all conversed in shouts for 10 days after. But St. Vincent was noisier. In what we call the slaughterhouse, where I was stationed at St. Vincent, that is the part of the gun deck in the middle of the ship, sir, you have 16 32-pounders in a row, all roaring away as fast as they can load and fire, recoiling and jumping up with a great crash when they are hot and running out again to fire. And then, just overhead, you have another row of guns thundering on the deck above. And then the smashing blow as the enemy's shot hits you, and maybe the crash of falling spars above and the screams of the wounded. And all this in such a smoke you can hardly see or breathe, and the men cheering like mad and sweating and gulping down water when there's a second's pause. At St. Vincent we fought both sides, which doubled the row. No, that's what you remember, the huge noise everywhere, the flashes in the darkness. And, he added, the importance of gunnery. Speed and accuracy and discipline. We were firing a broadside every 2 minutes, and they took 3.5 or 4. That's what wins the day.
So you were at St. Vincent too? Said the parson.
And at what other actions, if I'm not too indiscreet? I mean, apart from this last most daring capture of which we've all read.
Only small affairs. Skirmishing in the Mediterranean and the West Indies in the last war. That kind of thing, said Jack.
There was the Cacafuego, sir, I believe,
said Mr. Simmons with a smile.
It must have been wonderful when you were young, sir, said the midshipman, sick with envy. Nothing ever happens now.
I'm sure you'll forgive me if I seem personal, said the chaplain, but I should like to form an image of the officer who has seen, as you say, a moderate amount of fighting. In addition to your fleet actions, about how many others have you taken part in?
Why, upon my word, I forget, said Jack, feeling that the others had an unfair advantage of him, and feeling, too, that parsons were out of place in a man of war.
He signalled to Killick for fresh decanter and the roast, and as he set to carving, the flow of his mind changed as thoroughly as if an 18-pound shot had hulled the frigate. He felt a rising oppression in his bosom and choked, standing, bowed there, carving the venison. The First Lieutenant had long ago seen that Mr. Lydgate's persistence was disagreeable to Captain Aubrey, and he turned the conversation back to animals aboard. Dogs in ships he'd known, the Newfoundland that so lovingly brought a smoking grenade, the Culloden's pet crocodile, cats.
Dogs, said the chaplain, who was not one to leave his corner of the table silent long.
That reminded me of a question I had meant to put to you, gentlemen. This short watch that is about to come, or rather these two short watches, why are they called dog watches? Where is the canine connection?
Why, said Stephen, it is because they are curtailed, of course.
A total blank. Stephen gave a faint inward sigh, but he was used to this.
Mr. Butler, the bottle stands by you, said Jack. Mr. Lydgate, allow me to help you to a little of the undercut.
It was the midshipman who first reacted. He whispered to his neighbour Dashwood.
He said, curtailed.
The dog watch is curtailed. D'ye twig? It was the sort of wretched clench perfectly suited to the company. The spreading merriment, the relish, the thunderous mirth reached the forecastle, causing amazement and conjecture. Jack leant back in his chair, wiping the tears from his scarlet face, and cried,
"Oh, it's the best thing, the best thing! Bless you, Stephen, a glass of wine with you. Mr. Simmons, if we dine with the Admiral, you must ask me, and I will say why. It is because they have been docked, of course. No, 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 I'm out. Curtailed. Curtailed. And I doubt if I should ever be able to get it out gravely enough."
They did not dine with the Admiral, however. No loving messages answered their salute to the flagship. But the moment they dropped anchor in the crowded downs, Parker came aboard from the Fanchula with his brand new epaulette, to congratulate and to be congratulated. Jack felt a certain pang when the boat answered the Lively's hail with Fanchula, meaning that her captain was aboard.
But the sight of Parker's face as it came level with the deck, and the affection that beamed from it, did away with all repining. Parker looked 10, 15 years younger. He came up the side like a boy. He was wholly and absolutely delighted. He most bitterly regretted that he was under orders to sail within the hour, but he solemnly engaged Jack and Stephen to dine with him at the very next meeting. He thought curtailed by far the best thing he'd ever heard in his life, should certainly repeat it, but he'd always known that Dr. Maturin was a towering intellect, was still taking his pill morning and evening, and should continue to do so until the end of his life. And on leaving, he took Jack's hesitant... Captain Parker would not be offended if he suggested a relaxation, a curtailing of the cat, as he might say. Very well indeed. He said he should pay the utmost attention to advice from such an esteemed quarter, such a very, very highly esteemed quarter. On saying goodbye, he took both Jack's hands in his, and with tears in his small, close-set eyes, he said, "You don't know what it means, sir. Success at 56. Success at last. It changes a man's whole heart. Why, I could kiss the ship's boys." Jack's eyebrows shot into his bandage, but he returned Parker's fervent grip and saw him to the gangway. He was profoundly touched, and he stood there looking after the boat as it pulled over to the beautiful little sloop until the first lieutenant came up to him and said, "Mr. Dashwood has a request to make, sir, if you please. He would like to take his sister down to Portsmouth. She's married to a marine officer there." "Oh, certainly, Mr. Simmons. She'll be very welcome. She may have the after cabin, but stay. The after cabin is filled with..." "No, no, sir. He wouldn't hear of putting you out. It's only his sister. He'll sling a hammock in the gunroom, and she shall have his cabin. That is how we always did these things when Captain Hammond was aboard. Shall you be going ashore, sir?" "No. Killick will go to pick up my coxswain and some stores and salve against bee stings, but I shall stay aboard. Keep a boat for Dr. Maturin, however. I believe he will wish to go." "Good day to you, ma'am," he said, moving aside and taking off his hat, as Mrs. Armstrong, the gunner's wife, shook the gangway with her bulk. "Take care. Hold on to the side ropes with both hands."
"Bless you, sir," said Mrs. Armstrong with a jolly wheeze. "I've been in and out of ship since I was a little maid."
She took one basket between her teeth, two more under her left arm, and dropped into the boat like a midshipman. "That is an excellent woman, sir," said the first lieutenant, looking down into the hoveler. "She nursed me through a fever in Java, when Mr. Floris and the Dutch surgeons had given me up." "Well," said Jack, "there were women in the Ark, so I suppose there must be some good in them. But generally speaking, I've never known anything but trouble come of shipping them on a voyage. Quarrels, discussions, not enough to go round, jealousies. I don't even care for them in port. Drunkenness and a sick list as long as your arm. Not that this has the least bearing on Mrs. Gunner, of course, or the other warrant officers' wives. Still less to Mr. Dashwood's sister." "Ah, Stephen, there you are." Simmons withdrew. "I was just telling the First Lieutenant that you would probably be going ashore. You'll take the barge, will you not? Two of the supernumeraries are not to report aboard until the morning, so you'll have all the time in the world." Stephen looked at him with his strange, pale, unblinking eyes. Had that old constraint returned? That curious misery? Jack was looking anxious, unnaturally, inappropriately gay, a wretched actor. "Shall you not go, Jack?" he said.
"No, sir," said Jack. "I shall stay aboard."
"Between ourselves," he added in a much lower tone, "I don't believe I shall ever willingly set foot on shore again. Indeed, I've sworn an oath never to risk arrest. But
he cried with that painful, jarring, artificial assumption of levity that Stephen knew so well. "I must beg you to get some decent coffee when you go. Killick is no judge. He can tell good wine from bad, as you would expect in a smuggler, but he's no judge of coffee." Stephen nodded.
"I must also buy some issue peas," he said. "I shall call at New Place, and I shall look into the hospital. Have you any messages?"
"Compliments, of course. Best compliments, and my very kindest wishes to Babington and the other wounded Polycrests. This is for their comforts, if you please. MacDonald, too. Please tell Babington I'm particularly sorry not to be able to visit him. It's quite impossible."